Hello everyone, and welcome to This Nintendo Life. My name is NBZ, and Bally, I have one request of you.
What is that?
Execute episode 66.
This is suitable, isn't it?
It is quite suitable.
It is quite suitable, because it's also been my birthday this weekend.
It has been, and what birthday it is, Bally, because you share it with a special someone.
The one and only GL, George Lucas.
The big man, the one in charge, the Star Wars head honcho, who sold his baby to Disney. Just like Disney have sold their baby, which we'll talk about. But hey, welcome to This Nintendo Life. We're episode 66, double digits of the two same ones. I don't think we ever talk about that. That's cool. They're both the same number. I don't know. Cool. I'm just making... Also, because I've been watching Mario Party Party 6 on Giant Bomb, and every time they roll the same dice, it does a thing where the numbers dance, and Jeff Gerstmann was like, it felt like he was tripping out watching these numbers dance on the screen, because he was so tired from playing Mario Party for 4 hours. So, yeah, Mario Party kills people, it kills friendships, it kills everything, and... We played a lot of it when we were children, but you know.
Way too much is how much we played.
It was absurd. But we're not here to talk about Mario Party. Bally, we're here to talk about other things. Please tell everyone what we're here to discuss.
We're here to talk about the video games we've been playing in the first segment. In the second segment, we're going to talk through a few emails that everyone sent in. And then in the third segment, we've got a bit of a news roundup. There's been three pretty big stories, one of which was Nintendo announcing that there will no longer be any digital event at E3, on top of all of the terrible news from last time. Disney have also decided not to go on with Disney Infinity. And thirdly, I've forgotten the third thing. What was the third thing?
It's Pokemon, Bally. Pokemon. It's pretty important.
There was a Pokemon trailer, there were three new starters revealed, and... it all looked pretty cool, but we'll get to that in the third segment.
Of course, when it happens, it shall happen. But for now, it's all about the video games of yesteryear or this year. And Bally, I've now finished exams. I'm just fucking binging
I'm so jealous.
On games, mainly kind of getting through a bunch of short stuff in the lead up to Fire Emblem Fates finally coming out in Europe. Oh, I'm so excited. Can't tell you, Bally. I'm just itching at it. I'm itching for some Fire Emblem, which is why I'm actually playing quite a lot right now, because I'm recording the sixth game for my channel. I'm also live streaming Path of Radiance. So amongst that, I'm playing other games. But Bally, tell me about your stuff, because that's what really matters here.
I played a few short, small things, dabbled in a few things with my good friend Alex, who came around, visited me in Brussels. We played some things. I'll get to those in a bit. But the big thing I've been investing a ton of time into, I'd even argue maybe too much time, because this is a long, long game, and that is I finished up Metroid Prime 2. Echoes.
Yeah, so you talked about this last time, gave us your first impressions, your first, like, 10 hours or so. It seems like you've dumped loads more hours into Metroid Prime 2, and it seems like maybe it overstayed its welcome?
Yeah, I would say ever so slightly overstayed its welcome, probably more so than Prime 1. I mean, overall, I thought this game was incredibly brutal and incredibly long, and... I mean, that's not to say the game was bad, but it makes the game just tougher to play, if that makes sense. I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it as much, but it was really just at times like, oh, God, this game is just so hard. Where am I going? How do I do this? How do I defeat this boss? But I mean, sort of stuff I've discovered that I didn't talk about last time. So the third section of this game is... it looks incredible. I've forgotten the name, but it's basically a futuristic section. And it's got this incredible, like, sort of neon lighting. And then, like, when you go out onto the platforms of this area, you can, like, see, like, a whole city below you, like a cityscape as, like, a vista, like, at the sort of some of the save rooms and other high points in the game where you can sort of see across the land. Like, it's not land you can obviously access. It's just sort of infinite space that you can fall into. It just looked incredible, I thought. And unlike any other section of a Metroid game I've played before, it just felt really... like it stood out, especially as I think the first two sections of this game, one was like a watery sort of bog, as it were, and the other wasn't really any. It's like a dirt sort of desert place. They were both quite generic, whereas I just thought the game really stepped it up at the end with these really futuristic area, and that it included these really cool like robotic enemies, and they even had like lore behind these enemies where I've forgotten what they're called, Luminoth. Where the Luminoth talked about how they built all these security robots to protect them, but basically the Ing have taken over the robots. So in that section of the game, it's all these possessed robots that attack you all the time. It's quite cool. I quite like that.
Do you find yourself, like, later on doing much more jumping back and forth between dark and light, or did it kind of stick the course in terms of the balance between the two sections?
It stuck its course really consistently through the whole game. I think last time I said it was maybe 40% you spend in the dark
yeah. ether.
I'd say it's quite a bit lower than that. I'd go for 20 to 30% perhaps.
Oh, okay.
Overall. And yeah, really consistently. For example, I think all the bosses bar maybe two or three in the whole game are in dark ether. But other than that, it's very sort of specific things, linear corridors that you have to go through in the dark areas. And they never got tiresome. Like, I heard so much before playing this game about dark ether and how much of a pain it was that your health would go down. It felt like you would be jumping as fast as you could between safe spots. And it never really felt like that, because at the start of the game, obviously, like, you do lose a lot more health, but the safe spots are much closer, and then by the end of the game your health goes down very, very slowly, and then in the final stretch of the game you actually get the light suit, which just makes you invulnerable in the dark ether, which is cool. So it's like,
which I bet feels amazing at that point in time.
Well, you say amazing, but I never really felt much dread being, that's a great word to use, much dread.
Yeah. yeah, especially being, with the series.
Precisely, being in dark ether. It never hit me. So yeah, it was great to be in the light suit, but it wasn't like this massive bonus. So
it's not an equivalent to Space Jump's Drill Attack, where you feel like super, super cool.
Definitely not. It doesn't feel quite that powerful.
I guess because it's not really a power-up, it's just like this passive bonus you have. I guess maybe you could call it the equivalent to the gravity suit, where you can now walk through water without being slowed down or whatever.
Yeah, no, and there's actually other cool underwater power-ups you get. Like, you get this jetpack, which basically gives you this ridiculous jump underwater, which is quite handy, especially for one part of that bog area I talked about. But another area I think is really an improvement on Prime 1 is all of the morph ball stuff. Generally speaking, I'm talking spider ball. I thought some of the spider ball stuff in this game is fantastic. Like, it is so well implemented. I think
so. Remind me what the spider ball is all about, because I know that this was like something that was talked about as being part of Metroid 2. The spider ball is a power up there.
Yes.
And was this something in the original Prime?
Yes. So it's something where the 3D Prime games really shine in comparison to 2D. And obviously, yes, you're right. It is in Prime, not in Prime, in Metroid 2.
Yes.
On the Game Boy.
Return of Samus.
Got that right, yeah. Return of Samus. But so it's the ability to stick magnetically to specific tracks and sections of wall that you can just defy gravity and go wherever.
Right, yeah, yeah. Okay, they're coming into my brain now. I'm seeing them in my visual picture.
And it's just so cool because there are, like, so many boss fights, including the final boss and the second last boss. There are elements of their boss fights where they parts of, like, say, I don't know, their skull or their big head that you have to go on becomes magnetic, and then you have to stick to it and dodge all these enemies on them and actually manage to, like, plant a bomb inside them, and then sort of you jump off. And, like, it's really well implemented.
Feels like, you know, Minish Cap, where you have to go in, turn small and go inside that final boss
definitely.
And do all that stuff.
And that's a really cool thing that a number of Nintendo bosses do, and it's really cool that they could implement something similar with Metroid Prime 2. But the morph ball, like, there's whole boss fights where you're just in the morph ball. Like, to get the spider ball itself It was one of the toughest bosses in the game. I think it's called the Spider Guardian.
And... Right, there's a lot of, like, I don't think the creativeness really came to the fore when they were naming bosses in Prime 2. Because they're all like, Boost Guardian, Spider Guardian, all this different thing, and never really, like... there's some cool stuff like Quadraxis, which just sounds fucking rad. Yeah. But aside from, like, those... sparse named enemies, it seems like maybe a lack of personality. I don't know.
So other than there's basically one big boss per area, as in, like, so the big main three areas is one big boss, and then obviously there's a final boss in between those. There's three Dark Samus fights, and on top of all that you've got all the guardians. So all the guardians are all your weapons, basically. So
right, so you get upgrades from beating them, basically.
So for beating them you get that item, which it is what it is. I agree. It's maybe not the most creative thing, but definitely those big bosses, including Quadraxis, like you said, do make up for that. The Dark Samus fights are—they're cool. They're decent. It doesn't—if they feel—they don't feel very Metroid, because it's very rare, and obviously that you have a fight against the SAX in Fusion, but it feels it's very rare that Samus ever fights like another life-size.
Like a humanoid creature, really.
Exactly. Like, it's not really Metroid. And the idea...
I feel like you get that same moment when you're playing Ocarina of Time and you fight Shadow Link, right?
Yeah.
Like, you usually, in Zelda games, go up against these big, you know, hulking enemies. And when you're faced with something which is, like, a version of yourself, it becomes a very different style of you know, combat.
Hmm. Yeah, it's weird, and I think the animation and stuff like that of Dark Samus is pretty cool. I don't think any of the Dark Samus battles are particularly difficult, although I did die on sort of the final Dark Samus, and it's cool. Like, it's fine. I mean, in general, I don't think perhaps the maps are as well laid out as Prime 1. I think... It never...
Do you mean in terms of, like, interlinking together
exactly.
and moving across areas?
Although you do get a teleport at the very end of the game, which they don't really... The game hardly tells you about.
Which shocks me, by the way, because Metroid games, like, hardly ever have fast travel in them. It's
exactly.
one of those things that I think Symphony of the Night did so much better, was having the ability to warp between different areas of the castle, and why I think it has a leg up on Super Metroid is that ability to, like, explore way more conveniently later on in the game.
Yeah, and this game kind of needs it, because I feel like although there are sort of back corridors and things that do link the worlds, it doesn't feel like there are as many of them perhaps as Prime 1. And I swear Prime 1 has many more areas. This game basically has your hub area and three sort of separate areas that all link together to the hub area. Whereas
okay.
Prime 1 feels like it's this layered cake that just goes on, and there's...
Like an
loads.
Onion peeling itself
like
away.
Like an onion. Like, it feels quite complex, but still really easy to get around, whereas this feels a bit more linear in the way that it all links together. It's quite hard to explain, but I just warn that to anyone playing this game is just like Prime 1, because it definitely feels different in so many ways.
But the key question, Val, is it better than Prime 1? Does it do enough things better to make you enjoy it more, or did it kind of come down in your estimation?
It does some things better than Prime 1. Like I said, the spider ball stuff, the morph ball stuff, I love that. I think the boss fights in general are better. But Metroid isn't about just the boss fights and morph balls and things like that. It's the whole package. And
right.
In particular, world exploration and the part I just mentioned, how well the maps link up and stuff. That's a crucial part of Metroid, whether it's 2D or 3D. And I just think Prime 1 does that a lot better than this game does. I think the Dark Aether stuff is cool. I don't want to see it in every Metroid game, but I'm pleased this game did it. And, like, it's this game feels very distinctly different from Prime 1, and that's good. I just think some of the world design, like I said, is a bit sloppier. I think the story kind of takes a bad turn. I mean, but I'm going to get a bit spoilery here. Not that this game has the most interesting story.
I mean, you know, it's as
and it's a very old
game,
but
yeah.
At the start, you're sort of thinking, oh, there's space pirates and there's Metroids, there's Ing and there's you. By the end of the game, you barely see any Metroids. There's like a couple floating around, and then there's a couple of like Ing-infested Metroids later in the game. But there's nothing. And the space pirates who are infected by the Ing, there's regular space pirates, they never really do anything. You know that they're trying to harness the power of the Ing and all this because they're just greedy space pirates, blah, blah, blah. But come the end of the game, there's no Ridley, there's no leader of any space pirates, there's no... there's nothing talking about what happens to the space pirates when you defeat...
You know, I don't think that I would really mark that down as a negative, though, because it feels like, you know, you don't want to rely on those things consistently.
No, you don't.
I feel like Zelda gets bogged down and like, oh, Ganon's behind it all again, you know?
Yeah,
I
no,
I think it's
absolutely.
Kind of refreshing the fact that there's no Ridley and there's no Metroids. Like, it feels like you should be able to tell a story outside the bounds of, like, every game has to have this and every game has to have that, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe it's a bit more freeing.
I just think if you're going to do that, why put them in at all? Because they feel...
Right, okay, fair enough.
It's weird that they're all here.
So you'd have preferred it if they were just fully disconnected from the start and there was just, like, this is a new planet, new species, all that stuff is kind of, you know, shoved to
yeah,
the side.
Yeah, why do you have to have Metroids and space pirates? Just leave them to their own thing.
Yeah,
but
fair enough.
It's
fair
not
enough.
A big criticism, it's just a bit... You don't play Metroid for the story. It's not about that.
Very true.
It's interesting. You defeat the Ing. You escape Dark Aether. Dark Aether seems to like close up or something. All the Luminoth basically give Samus a guard of honor, and then you go back to your ship and fly away. It's not that exciting,
yeah.
But
it's
you know, okay.
Yeah.
I think, like I said, Prime 1 does it all a bit slicker. It's a shorter game. It's punchier. Unfortunately, both Prime 1 and Prime 2 have a stupid collectathon before the final boss, which is just the most stupid thing.
Oh, Bally, you know, all your favorite games seem to have this. The Wind Waker and Metro Prime and now Prime 2.
Hey, you like Skyward Sword. That's got plenty of this crap.
There, you know, I will not deny it. I will not deny it.
But I just think this is such a long game. Prime 1's a long game too. You don't need any padding. It's such a solid experience otherwise. But overall, super happy with this game. I loved it. I can't say I loved every moment of it because some bits it was like, ugh, don't make me do that. But overall, it does its own thing and it does its own thing really well. Does that mean it's as good as Prime 1? Not quite, but is it still... an incredible Prime game, yes. And I highly recommend it, even if it is a ramp up in difficulty, I'd say, from Prime 1.
Do you think that people just jumping straight into Prime 2 would be a disadvantage, having not played the first one? Do you think it's like the
yes.
sort of thing where it picks up
yes.
straight away?
Yes.
I guess that's why I had such trouble when I played it. You know?
Maybe. I mean, I would argue the stage you got to wasn't perhaps too challenging, but...
I was also incompetent and young.
You were incompetent, we were all young, blah, blah, blah. I know, but I definitely play Prime 1 and experience that more. I think perhaps motion controls aren't the best for this game. I can imagine playing it in the same way I played Prime 1 being quite nice, but I've not played this game with a gamepad, so I don't know, but who knows.
Well, you know, I have a copy of the GameCube version. I could always lend it to you, Bally. You know,
well, I'm not going to play it again anytime soon, because it was tough. But yeah. I look forward to you at least maybe dipping your toe back in one day. But
one day.
Very, very quickly, the couple of games I played with Alex, we did a bit of co-op Guacamelee. I'd never really done co-op Guacamelee before. He started.
I keep forgetting that Guacamelee even has co-op in it, but
it's
yeah,
cool.
It, does.
It makes those, you know, locked off beat 'em up rooms, sections, and bosses and things like that a bit more simple, and it's quite fun just going to separate areas of the stage, throwing enemies into each other's paths to like kick and
oh can you do a
punch.
Thing where you like throw an enemy at your friend and they catch them and throw them back like a tennis ball or something, or is
I
that
mean
not
yeah
part of
you
mechanics?
Can you can tease someone up with an enemy and then they can kick them, yeah, you can do
oh that's awesome
stuff like that. It's cool. I just completely forgot how slick Guacamelee was, and I think my friend was pretty convinced how great it was. We also played a bit of Runbo. It's pretty cool. I think it's not the best with two players. I think it's perhaps better with 3, 4, 5, 6 players, because it's ultimately, you know, 2D platforming party game. Which is quite an interesting concept that maybe doesn't work quite as well with two players. But we had a good time. Like, there's different modes. There's one mode where you're just racing each other through the level. There's another one where you're trying to survive as long as possible. It's got online play that I've not tried yet. I mean, I'm going to spend a lot more time with this game later down the line. But it's pretty cool. I think we should play it sometime.
Yeah, totally. Again, a lot of these like Humble Bundle things that we probably wouldn't have gotten otherwise, and I think it's cool that we're getting exposed to them. So yeah, Runbow will be talked about probably later in the future of the podcast.
And finally, another game that you and me, MBZ, have to play. And I was so impressed by this game from like the sort of hour I played with my friend Alex's Affordable Space Adventures.
I was really surprised when you texted me and you're like, oh my god, this game is so fucking cool, we need to play this. I was like, oh wow, okay, geez. Very, very high praise.
It's like one of the most unique things. And I'm not going to say that it jolts out the gate at the start of the game in terms of being a cool thing, because you gradually build up more stuff. And to be clear, one person is basically controlling, they're the engineer, they're controlling the engine, the heating, the electricity, the petrol, fuel, sound, all the stuff that they control. And the other guy is the pilot, and they just steer the ship around basically and aim the reticle. And it's just a great combination of teamwork, and it was quite funny how frustrated my mate Alex got a number of times, and that's basically because I was mucking up and pressing the wrong buttons. It's a really, really cool game, because you have to get it's genuinely stealth puzzle. It's great, and it's co-op stealth puzzle, and you have
and it also uses the Wii U gamepad in an asymmetric fashion that is pretty cool.
Exactly, you've got all these. You've got basically a HUD of your engine as the engineer on the gamepad, and using the stylus to ramp up how fast you're going, your heat, whether you're on the scanner or the gun or whatever, you're flicking all these things all the time, and you're watching the screen making sure that the enemies you're approaching are happy for you to pass. That's the key. You're like sneaking past these robots by making sure that they're not picking up too much heat or too much noise, and you're having to change the way that you control your engine to adhere to what the robot needs. So
right.
It's really cool, and I think the engineers may be a bit more unique and fun and quirky than the pilot, but I think when we play this MBZ, it'd be quite cool to swap every now and then, because it's a really interesting game, and I can't wait to play this through. I think it's only 6 hours, so we're gonna belt through this sometime, hopefully this summer.
Yeah,
but sorry, I've overrun a bit today, but
that's fine. You know,
I've been on
Metroid Prime 2 is a chunky monkey.
Oh, so yeah. Chunky
deserves a lot of talk. But I know, Bally, you're keen to finally dig into Star Fox.
Oh,
and you
yes.
Have it ready.
It's all teed up for next time.
Excellent. So we'll hear about your thoughts finally on Star Fox Zero to add to the ongoing conversation that game has had in recent times. Yes, until we get to that, let's talk about the video games I've been playing. I've been playing fucking everything.
Everything.
So, yeah, I've been Stardewing as usual. I think I'm close to finishing being done with Stardew, which means just me stopping, because there's not an end point of Stardew Valley.
That would be good for your health, I think.
It would probably, although, I don't know, the thing is, like, it's such a good game to stick on, because I've accumulated an enormous backlog of podcasts, having all this revision and exams to do, so I just need to burn through stuff, and it's so, like, mindless that it's so good to have something just to push me and to have on in the background. So I don't know if that's actually going to happen, but, you know, whatever. Really, what I dug into was two games. The first being, again, talking about the Nintendo Humble Bundle, was Shantae and the Pirate's Curse. And so I've never played a Shantae game before. I've always been intrigued by the series, interested. They're very much on Nintendo platforms. WayForward is a developer that generally puts stuff out for Nintendo. And Pirate's Curse was curious because this is one that Johnny Metz on RFN had mentioned in his 2014 Game of the Year list. Granted, 2014 wasn't the best year for Nintendo games or games generally, but he put it in at number 4 on his list. And I remember him saying that he'd never really liked a Shantae game before, but this was the one that convinced him. This was one that got him and that he really liked. So I was very intrigued to jump in. Did the 3DS version. You get both with the Humble Bundle. 3DS I chose because I like playing these games portably. kind of 2D side scrolling, and I am a big fan of 3D effect. I know both of us are,
yeah.
But that's something that really helps, you know, leverage the visual fidelity for me personally. So jump in, and first thing that hits me smack across the face is, oh my god, this music is rad. And later down the line, like, I'm listening to some of the tracks, and they sound really Shovel Knight-esque, and I'm like, wait a second, is this Jake Kaufman who did this soundtrack? And I Google it, and I'm like, oh my god, it is. This is Jake Kaufman who did the Shovel Knight soundtrack.
Oh my god, I'm excited for this game now.
Yeah, so, like, the first song hits, and I'm like, oh, Matt, this is a banging tune. Like, this is really fucking good. That continued throughout the game. It meant that I wasn't listening to as many podcasts while playing it, because I really liked the music. But, like, Bally, you being a fan of, you know, aesthetics and music all symbiotically moving together, yeah. I think Shantae will hit the feels for you.
Cool.
Because it looks really nice, such great sprite design. It's really colourful, really pops out. The 3D effect is excellent. And it's rather interesting because they leverage the 3D effect for certain body parts of the female characters in this game. There's something Zach Miller of Nintendo World Report is a big fan of anime ladies. there's some 3D usage with anime ladies, if you infer my meaning here. It's weird, but also kind of cool. I don't know. But generally, the 3D effect is great, and it looks awesome, sounds good. I think, like, from that standpoint, it knocks out the park. I think there are problems with the other aspects of it. I think that the way the game is set up is there are multiple different islands that you go to, and on these islands you have kind of dungeon areas which look like, on the bottom screen, the map and stuff is very tile-based. It's very Metroid. It's like, you know, going to rooms and finding enemies and getting doors unlocked and everything. And it feels like kind of these mini self-contained Metroid maps, almost. And those are great, because that's the kind of gameplay I love, is just discovering and moving through, upgrading, all that shit. The problem comes in, like, the area between going to the island and getting to that kind of main meet, because every single island has this long stretch which is just linear and filled with enemies, and the enemies do, like, a good amount of damage to you. So if you try and rush through, you're going to be really punished, you're going to die, and you're going to have to start again. So what it entails is really slow, plodding progression to defeat these enemies, to get through to the area. It just slows the pace to a fucking crawl, and it makes you go through these, like, multiple times, like going there, coming back, going there again because there's an item that you need for another thing, and coming back. It just, it's one of those things that kills my enjoyment of just the pace and the momentum of this style of game that it usually would have. So that's really a pain in the ass. I think it's also really unclear in certain parts where you'll know that you need to go to this new island, but you can't get through yet because you're missing a certain item. And you look in your inventory and you have all this stuff, and it's like, okay, so there's this one thing where you have to find this travel brochure which has fallen down a well, and so you go and get it and you give it to this guy, and then he's like, okay. And then you're like, okay, but I didn't get the thing that I needed. So you need to actually take the travel brochure to this other person who will give you this other thing, which it doesn't make it clear at all why you would give it to that person or how you would get this other thing that you needed. It's just, it doesn't make any sense. And it feels like the kind of obscure that is the original Legend of Zelda burning around in bushes. You know, it's just this wandering in the dark feeling of, who do I talk to? There's loads of characters, and there's, like, five islands, and I don't know where I specifically need to go.
Did you jump to a guide, or did you just...
Oh, totally. Your head, yeah, as soon as that stuff came up, I was like, I'm not wasting my time on this. I just want to move on. And I'm glad I did, because it seems like the sort of thing where I just run and hit myself against the wall constantly. It seemed really stupid. But yeah, for all its faults, I don't know. I think it's a solid game. It's very enjoyable. It's fun to play, I think. It can be broken. No, it's like 7 hours. It took me 6.5, maybe. So it's not. It doesn't outstay its welcome. It's definitely, like, it can be broken in the sense that you go and upgrade. Your main kind of form of attack is whipping your hair. like, what's her name? Fucking Willow Smith whipped my hair back and forth. and so the hitbox of that is kind of a little too small for my taste. Like, some enemies are really short, and so you can duck down and hit them. But then there are parts where you're like, you have to jump and hit at the same time, and it feels like the window for attack is a little bit too narrow. So that can cause, like, some, you know, problems maybe. But you also, like, you can upgrade your hair to whip faster, you can increase the damage it does, and you can also buy this item which increases the amount of damage you do for a short period of time. And there's also items which act like kind of fairies in Zelda, which will revive you if you die. So it basically comes down to this point against bosses where the bosses are ridiculously spongy and have loads of fucking HP. And so what you end up doing is, like, I'm just going to spam all these items, and I'm just going to hit them as quick as possible, and you can just basically not care about how well you're playing, essentially.
When you say, like, items, are they almost like the Shovel Knight items, or what
do you mean? No, when I say items, I mean, like, there's, like Fairy in Zelda, you know, like a reusable, like, one-time thing, you know, where it just disappears and is gone. So that sort of stuff. I mean, the upgrades are permanent, like increasing the damage your hair does and that sort of stuff. And even that stuff's kind of hidden. It's like in a shop off to the side. And if you don't find it, I didn't find it until like the third island. I was like, oh, that's why I'm doing so little damage and my hair's so slow and all this shit. Like, I could have been doing way more and making it easier for myself. But I wasn't, so whatever. But yeah, I think you'll enjoy it, Bally. I think it's worth a play, if not for, you know, the visuals and the music alone. I think those Metroid areas will be fun, but there's just a lot of shit that bogs it down, which I wasn't really a fan of, unfortunately. Yeah, definitely you should check it out. The other thing is a game that I just wanted to rush to beat before Fire Emblem came out, and it is the Pokemon Killer, they call it, although I don't think it's really done that. Yo-Kai Watch, a game I've been waiting to dig into for a really long time since, like, hearing the guys at 8-4 talk about it. The Japanese kids are just fucking rabid for the Yo-Kai Watch. It's really weird. It's Japanese as hell. And I think one of the interesting things that I noticed is Pokemon has this kind of universal design aesthetic where you look at Pokemon and you look at all the different characters and they do not necessarily scream, I'm from Japan, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they look like animals that are kind of universal and could be understood and from anywhere. You look at yokai, and they scream, I'm fucking Japanese, top to bottom. Like, it's just so, so different in terms of how they look. And I feel like that may hurt it in terms of marketing to people here, because a lot of them just feel the same. And it's one of those things where, you know how sometimes in, like, well, you don't play other RPGs, but this is a thing in RPGs where you have enemies who you will fight early on in the game, and then later on you'll fight it again, but with a different color palette, you know?
Yeah.
There's lots of yokai which feel like, this is a yokai, this is another one with a different color palette, kind of. You know, like an evolution that doesn't look that different or whatever. And that's the sort of thing where it just, like, it made me not care about collecting yokai in the same way that getting Pokemon is cool. It's like, I just don't really need any of these. They just weren't visually appealing to me.
Does it feel distinctly more kiddie and simple than Pokemon?
Yes. Yeah, and I think mainly that's the battle system, which it's hard to describe, but nuts and bolts, you generally have three yokai out in front, all attacking at once. Imagine, you know, rotation battles in Pokemon, right?
Mm.
Where you can kind of have six
Pokemon on a
wheel. I
still don't really understand them, but okay.
No, you don't need to. You just need to understand the concept, right? That they're on a wheel and you spin it around. So yokai are on a wheel and you can spin them around in real time, so you can just switch on the fly, but their attacks are automatic. So think like Xenoblade, like the attacks happen just by standing next to enemies, right? That's what happens here. They attack automatically. The way you come in is on the touchscreen, you use certain special moves and you do touchscreen mini games to activate them. So you have to wait for this meter to fill up, then you do a special move and it'll do like a bunch of damage, and that's mainly where your attacks are coming from. That's when you're really, you know, hitting the enemy hard and hoping to kill them. But also on the touchscreen, you're using items to heal people, you're using a target reticle to focus on what enemy you want to attack, and you're also doing this thing called purifying, which if you've like undertaken a status effect or something, you can spin the yokai out of combat and then purify it by doing another touchscreen minigame. And while that's happening, like you have other people in the front lines, and so you're constantly having to have three up front and doing stuff. And while it sounds simple, like, it definitely ramps up, and I understood like why they implemented it, because it gets a little frantic, like doing a lot of stuff at once and you're kind of speeding through. But the game's never that hard. Like, it feels very pitched to a younger audience in terms of difficulty, where I didn't die a single time in the entire game. And it feels like it has that kind of barrier of like softness, almost. Like, you can just sit there and let them do their thing, and generally you'll be okay as long as your level is high enough, you know? So it's just a strange thing. But the nice thing about it is the battles go by really quickly, so it's always a quick pace, and you're always like onto the next. And the other thing I like about it is there's no random battles, which means no kind of running into enemies constantly. You'll always see them on the map, so if you're gonna fight something, you'll run directly into it. But I think the area that this game really puts Pokemon to shame is how well it runs and how good it looks. Like, because I think the 3DS has a good amount of power to be leveraged, and I just don't think Game Freak do a good job of it. The fact that in Pokemon X and Y you can't turn on the 3D in the overworld, and the fact that when you go into battle it drops down to 30 FPS. Yo-Kai Watch can be played full 60 FPS in 3D all the time, every time. And it looks amazing! It's one of the best looking 3DS games. Like, the character models are so beautifully rendered. They have this cartoon aesthetic to them, but it also has kind of this cel-shaded element, and like the special moves that happen in battle look like outstanding. It just looks really good, and it just makes me think, what the fuck are you doing, Game Freak? Like, look at what level 5 are pulling out of this system. It's really awesome. And it sucks that, like, they can't do that on the Pokemon end. I don't know what's up with it.
We're going to get to it in the third segment, but I think that trailer looked like a bit of a step up, right? Or you think that's still a big gulf between that and Yo-Kai Watch?
I mean, it does. Like, I'm not sure it's a step up for Pokemon. I think, like, they changed the art style because they're no longer chibi characters. They're now actual characters. But yeah, there's something about, like, the way that the characters are drawn is much more appealing to me. Like, Pokemon X and Y and Sun and Moon definitely look more polygonal, you know? Whereas these characters have more rounded edges to them, and they look smoother. And they definitely, like, the idea of a Saturday morning cartoon is so present. Every kind of story mission feels like this is the kind of narrative that you would contain in a 20-minute episode of a cartoon show, you know? Like, simple plot, a bit of conflict, some resolution, nothing too crazy, something very kid-friendly, but, like, uniquely satisfying in its own right, you know? And that's, like, kind of how it goes along. The game was a lot shorter than I thought it would be. I was looking on, like, how long usually people take, and they said, like, 20 hours. I beat it in 13. And whoa. I think I was, yeah, I really kind of blitzed through it, mainly because I was enjoying myself a lot. I was doing all these side quests and like exploring the town and going around and helping people and all that stuff. And then it got to a point when a lot of the side quests were like, well, to do this side quest, you need to have this yokai. And I think the most frustrating thing about Yo-Kai Watch is catching yokai and getting them, because it feels like something that you would have to sit with a guide in order to get what you wanted. Like, where do I go to get this specific one? Oh, to this place. But I need to... The way you catch yokai is you throw food at them, and if it's their favorite food, they'll like it, and then you kill them, and then after the battle, they'll be like, oh, I want to be your friend now. But the problem is, you never know what the fuck their favorite food is, and then there's still the risk, even if you give them their favorite food, maybe the RNG will fuck you and they won't come and say, hi, I want to be your friend. Like, it doesn't feel as concrete as throwing a Pokeball at something and just watching it wobble, you know? Like, there's no... I mean, there's RNG in Pokeballs, but it's a tangible, like, I know what I need to do to get this sort of thing. Whereas Yo-Kai is just like, fuck, I don't know. So I ended up using most of the guys I used were things that I got through the progression of the story. It's like, because of this story event, you're friends with this guy, so you can use him, right? And generally, those guys were good enough to where I was able to bust through the game no problem. It's easy, as I said, so it wasn't really a big deal. But yeah, that is one thing that like annoyed me. It was like, And the funny thing is, like, sometimes you'll beat yokai and you'll already have it. So I'm like, nah, I don't want to be this guy's friend. And it's really sad because it's like, the yokai, like, slumped off sadly, like, being rejected as your friend. It makes you feel really terrible for, like, saying, no, I don't want you on my team, which I thought was quite funny. Yeah, it's definitely the sort of thing that an experienced player will not have much trouble with. But I do think, yeah, I think it outstayed its welcome in the sense that the side quests were getting very repetitive and I felt like I needed some kind of resolution and end game. And so I kind of just blasted my way through. I kind of came out the other side and was like, well, you know, that was fun. I enjoyed it. I think there are a lot of cool elements to it. But like Pokemon, I feel if another Yo-Kai Watch gets localized, I don't think I would play it because I think it's probably going to be very similar. I think they will not change much and it's probably going to be the same style. And though I enjoyed it for what it was, I think it's the kind of thing where maybe in like 4 or 5 entries time, I'll jump back in and see what the sweeping big changes have been. You know, like you who have played Red and Blue and now you're going to play Sun and Moon later this year and that's going to be a massive jump, you know. I imagine like Yo-Kai Watch 6 or whatever I'll play and I'll be like, oh shit, they did some really cool different things. But yeah, it is worth playing. I will say that it is a unique experience and hell, it's one of the best looking 3DS games, so for the visual, for the eye candy alone, it's definitely worth a shot.
It's crazy some of the tweets I've seen in relation to this game in terms of what Nintendo have been promoting this on. It's like some, I can't even remember what it was. I think it was something to do with farting, or there was one to do with like cleaning and like washing, and it's so weird. Like,
There's an elephant that makes you need to go to the toilet.
That's it.
Fidgerfant. If it's standing near you, you'll need to go to the toilet. That's like the crux of the yokai. Is what does a yokai do? Basically, it's the sort of thing which causes disturbances in the human world, but they're invisible to the human world. And the whole conceit is you're this kid who has the watch who can see them and talk to them and everything. So that's like a lot of the side quests, like one of the first ones, or this is the main story, is like you come home and your parents are having an argument. It's like, why are they having an argument? Because there's a yokai making them mad at each other, so you need to get rid of him, you know? It's that kind of thing where it's like rationalizing, I guess, to young kids, like, oh, it's fine. It's, you know, your parents aren't really mad. They're just, there's a yokai.
It's just a yokai.
Right? I don't know. Yeah, it's all a grand metaphor, really. It's all about like this is how you explain politics to kids. It's like, you know, that man doesn't like that other guy. It's a yokai, I'll tell you what. So it is.
He's got that yokai next to him that makes him want to invade another country. Oh no!
Oh no! What a shame! No. It's like, oh, it's fine, Mom. It's just a yokai. Like,
silly
I know.
President.
Oh, silly, silly. Well, there we go. I think, Bally, you can borrow this at some point and let me know what you think. Yeah, it's certainly worth a look, if nothing else. It's a unique kind of weird, and I enjoy unique kinds of weird, so down my alley. That's going to be it for what we've been playing. Hell of a segment, lots of things to talk about. But we'll be back in a little bit after the musical break with some of your listener emails. So do not go anywhere, we shall return.
And we're back. It's that time again. It's time for the emails part of the show. Everyone's been writing in. We've got loads of emails to get through. We're going to go through a few today, but as always, we always need more. And the email address is thisnintendolife@gmail.com. That's thisnintendolife@gmail.com.
We need something to read around E3 time, guys, because Nintendo's not going to give us anything to talk about. So please send in your emails so that we have something to talk about at E3.
Yes,
it would be very good.
We read them all. Our first question email is from Alex C. Dear MBZ and Bally, hello gents. Now that I am done re-listening to every episode of your wonderful podcast, I've come to realize how infrequently I've written in with questions, a situation I plan on changing going forward. I also just want to say really quickly that even though I originally started listening to the show because I've been a big fan of MBZs for a long time, I actually find myself siding with Bally most of the time. Wind Waker is better than Galaxy 2. My question this week is, what is your gaming shame? This could be a game you started but never went back to finish, a game you secretly love that most other people despise, a part of a game that took a long time to figure out but had a simple solution. For me personally, there are plenty of examples I could bring up, but I think the most egregious one is that my Twitter handle is @AtariAlex, but I have never played an Atari. I only picked the name because it's alliterative. Thanks, Alex. P.S. MBZ, your inability to finish Twilight Princess LP doesn't count.
Well, touche.
Bro, shots fired.
Shots fired, I'll tell you what. Twilight Princess LP shall never die. It'll be the longest running LP in the history of YouTube. And you shall live to never see its completion.
you're just going for that Guinness Book of Records.
Yes, that is. This is the only reason. It's the Guinness Book of World Records. I have to get in there. Someday, somehow. So, Bally, how do you feel about gaming shames? He's got a few different interpretations of gaming shame. Should we go through like each of these and maybe pick something for the both of us? So a game you've started but never went back to finish. I think... For you, I don't know if you're going to...
Where's my mouth?
Sorry? Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm going to speak in lieu of yourself. I would say Mario Sunshine is probably the biggest glaring example that you have.
I completely agree. I love that game. It's a very hard game, and I've not gone back and finished it yet. It's definitely something I want to do. I'm always looking forward to an HD remake of that game, but it's definitely one. My gaming shame in general is that I am the biggest Nintendo fanboy and have hardly played any games on other consoles. I would love to experience stuff like Uncharted, stuff like The Witcher. I don't know, there's a long, long list of games that you've played and others have played that I'd love to try out, but don't own the correct systems to play, but I would certainly love to play them. In terms of Nintendo, I think my other gaming shame... I mean, since starting this podcast, I've tried to try everything, if that makes sense.
We've
also tried
to tick off things that are on our gaming shame,
Definitely.
Like, a lot of old games we never played before that we have now kind of comprehensive knowledge of.
Yeah, I hadn't played loads of Nintendo games, and now games that used to be my gaming shame are now some of my favorite games, especially the Prime series, Metroid games in general. I think that...
Yeah, how staggering is that? Is before we started this podcast, you'd never played a Metroid game.
Yep, not one.
I'm just thinking about it, like, oh my god, yeah, that's totally true. It's really weird.
So, that would be mine. I can do parts later, but what would you say are your big games that you've not, you know...
Oh god. Overall, I mean, I'm trying to, like, dig back into that RPG history right now, having played Chrono Trigger, Final Fantasy VII, stuff like that. There's still a lot, and I think... An interesting one is just a lot of PC, like old PC games like Doom and that kind of stuff, which everyone talks about like reverently, and stuff like RTSs, which I've never really gotten into. There's lots of genres, I think, which I just don't have any knowledge of. I think like playing something like StarCraft 2 or something would be interesting in the future, or like a Civilization game, you know, lots of these weird PC titles that now I have a good PC. I could go into. Funny thing about my PC is I basically treat it like a console. I most of the time play on an Xbox 360 pad hooked up via USB. Like the only time I use keyboard and mouse is for shooting things, and that's rarely because I don't play that many of those games Titanfall being like the main one. So yeah, it's really like, I got this PC because we're in an era with Steam and everything where most console games have PC ports, and as such I can play like better versions of them on this hardware for cheaper prices, essentially. But yeah, I would say big gaming shames is all old PC stuff.
What
probably.
About Nintendo?
Oh man, I still haven't played Super Mario World. That's pretty huge. I think I will sometime soon. I think especially after playing Mario Maker and having Super Mario World as a tile set, which I think is by far the most interesting. You have so many mechanics that you can toy with that interact with one another, like the ability to throw items up in the air and all the stuff with the cape. Like, there's lots of fascinating like nuances to that tile set that makes me think playing the original Super Mario World would be a great experience. Although I know you don't like it that much, Bally. I don't know, like, maybe having played more Mario Maker, I would go back and feel differently than you have. I'm not sure.
I think you would be surprised, perhaps, at how infrequently a lot of the mechanics that people use in the tile set of Mario World are actually utilized often in the actual game. But, I mean, you need to play it and experience it, I'd say. But
I guess the spin jump as well, which is something that definitely, like, people use loads in levels. But
Metroid Prime.
Well, look, Bally, this is about gaming shames. This isn't about gaming shit piles. So
whoa!
Shots fired.
I'm afraid you're gonna have to accept that a lot of people love a bit of Metroid Prime.
I know. Look. I've always said, Bally, one day I'm not going to tell you that I'm going to go and beat Metroid Prime on my own. I'm not going to tell you about it, and we're going to start the podcast, and I'm going to be like, so I beat Metroid Prime, and you're going to be like, whoa! I guarantee you, ladies and gentlemen, this will happen. But into the individual questions he asks, a game you started but never went back to finish, I think for a long time it was Xenoblade, but I did finish that. At the moment, the big one is Batman Arkham Asylum. That game I got on PS3 a while ago, really loved it, played it for like 2 days straight, and like got like 4 or 5 hours in, and then just put it down, I think because I also got Uncharted 2 around the same time, and I just started Uncharted 2 and just barreled through that because it's amazing, and I just didn't go back to it. And then like later on PC, I picked it up, and I started it back last like October. But then Metal Gear Solid 5 came out. Actually, it was September, because that's when MGS5 came out. And all of a sudden, I'd started this game, I was intending on playing it, and then it got trampled by something else, and I still haven't got back to it. Arkham Asylum is the big, big one that it's just staring me in the face constantly. I'm like, I need to do that sometime. I really need to get to it. And it'll happen,
Has there been part of a game that you've just, like, completely struggled with that someone else's, or other people have found easier?
God, it's hard to think of like specific examples.
I've got one.
Of that
final boss of Skyward Sword I found really tough.
Well, no, I'll level with you, Bally. Like, that boss is pretty difficult. I died twice on it. I beat it on my third time, and usually when it comes to Zelda bosses I can do them first time. Mostly Skyward Sword has uniquely challenging bosses, but I think you probably had a big struggle with it.
Yeah, I did. But I enjoyed that game. Definitely not going against that game, but it was good fun.
Yeah, it's hard for me to think of specific examples in the moment. I'm sure there are many of them, but yeah, it's nothing's coming to mind. And as for like a game you secretly love that most other people despise, I don't really secretly love things. I'll tell you if I love it or not, like Codename Steam, and I will shout it from the rooftops. I'm not going to hide that away like an embarrassing thing. So,
how about next question?
All right, let's move on.
So it's from Chaotix. Hi, I'm BZ and Bally. Following on from a random tweet Bally did a while ago regarding the secret levels of Super Mario Land 2, what do you two see as completing a game? Beating the main story or taking care of every single element of the game? Is there a criterion you follow, or do you just take this depending on the game? Fellow gaming perfectionist, Chaotix, and their Twitter account is @ChaoticsTheRobot.
Well, I think this is a matter of semantics, Bally. In terms of the verbiage, when he says completing a game, I think, what do you perceive by the word completing, right? Because if you go to backloggery, a game that is quote-unquote completed is a game that you have done everything in and 100%ed. Yeah. Whereas something that has been beaten is just you've just finished the main thing and don't intend to do extra stuff. So, semantics question aside, what does, like, finishing a game mean to you, completing a game mean to you personally?
For me, it's the main story, but I would have to say that perhaps with a game like a 3D Mario game, I do actually think getting everything has almost become a part of those games in some way.
Yeah. No, I see what you mean. I do think, like, when I played Galaxy, 3D Land, all that stuff, I never move on and think, like, I'm going to just leave it without collecting stuff. There are other games like Yoshi's Woolly World where there's kind of equal... I mean, there's probably a bit more stuff to collect in those games, but it doesn't feel as necessary, and I think it has to do with your ability to unlock, like, these super interesting, well-designed, very difficult levels in those Mario games, that because I'm so invested in playing that great stuff, I want to go back and do and find all the other stuff. And this is also, this is something that Patrick Klepek talks about, is playing those games without going for the collectibles doesn't feel like you're really getting the full experience. Like, definitely, it doesn't feel like you're experiencing how well designed they are, because that stuff is the most interesting parts of those levels, and finding and discovering those things is the most rewarding. So I'd agree with you there, yeah.
Definitely, and I think the stuff like Metroid and Zelda that has energy tanks or heart pieces and missile expansions and all that sort of thing. I don't try to go for all of those, but I try to go for some of those, because obviously they help you in the beating the main story, and they're just sort of like a nice thing to do, and they're often hidden in cool parts, and you're exploring more of the game. But I am definitely not much of a completionist when it comes to games. In general, there's definitely a few games that I've gone a bit crazy on when it comes to wanting to complete them.
I think when it comes to Metroid and Zelda, a lot of the time I'm kind of nearing the end of the game and I just want to push through and finish, and I want to see the end, you know? And I think if I get too hung up on finding everything, it maybe sucks a lot of the momentum out of the campaign and the movement forward. And so I would maybe want to do that stuff later, but it never really ends up happening. Because, like, once you beat a game, I tend to walk away from it and be like, okay, that's that. That's done. What's next, you know? So, I have in the past tried with attempting 100%ing those style things, but it's not really something that I yearn for, honestly. And yeah, I guess like completing a game in terms of 100%ing, it's a case by case basis for me. If it's something like Ori and the Blind Forest, in which I just loved being in that world and moving around in it because the mechanics were so fluid, that's the sort of thing where I'm like, yeah, I want to do absolutely everything and find it all before I finish it. But I think that's very rare for me, because I like moving through a lot of games.
But we love beating them and just getting that nice big B sign, you know, on your game.
Sure.
Backlog, it's the most satisfying thing, even if we might not have finished it technically.
True, you know? True.
We love it. Our next question is from Mike, who's from the UK. Hey, Bally and MBZ, great show as always. As a mature gamer in the UK, I own a PS4 and a Wii U, plus a Vita, which I do not have time to use. I do find myself, depending on the mood, preferring one console or another at different times. I love my PS4 and spending all my time playing the Division, but do intend to play the Twilight Princess HD, which is sitting in its beautiful packaging in pristine condition when I have exhausted my time in the Dark Zone. I've decided to buy the PSVR in October, and as this does require a fairly big lump of cash, especially if a couple of games are added to the cost, and I'm wondering what you think the impact PSVR will have on NX sales and its release. I do appreciate that they are different beasts, but I'm sure there are Nintendo fans who also own another console for their gaming who may not be able to afford both. What do you think about the worrying news that just when the NX processing power is estimated to be on par with the power of an Xbone/PS4, which would potentially attract more buyers, Sony and Microsoft announce revised, more powerful versions of their own modern consoles. It does make me concerned that Nintendo are forever to be consigned to reside outside of the mainstream choice when a console is considered. Not to mention Nintendo are probably throwing everything they have got into the NX, whose success needs to be assured, or we could see the demise of the Big N as a hardware manufacturer and possibly doing a Sega and becoming software publisher only. All the best, Mike.
Okay, well, Mike sent this, I think, before the news about NX not being this year. So the impact of PSVR doesn't seem like a relevant question anymore. But the idea of power and of processing power versus the incremental upgrades of their competitors is, I guess, a concerning one. But the question is, does it really matter? You know, like, when I think about power and I think about its relevance throughout the generations, PS4 being the most powerful and also the best selling at the moment is a unique situation, I think. I think the success of PS4 was more contingent on different factors that weren't to do with power. For example, it being $100 cheaper than Microsoft out the gate, and it didn't have any Kinect or anything bundled in. It being marketed supremely well, mainly capitalizing on Microsoft's weaknesses and just going for the throat there, and just having good third-party relationships with like exclusive content on their platform and all that stuff. I don't think that PS4 being the most powerful platform has really done much in terms of helping it outside of it being a marketing buzzword. And so NX being as powerful, more powerful, whatever, it's happened before where GameCube is more powerful than PS2 and it hasn't moved the needle. Like, it didn't do anything. So I really wonder, like, does it even matter? Like, I know that in the media people would be like, oh, it's underpowered, that's why it's doing poorly. Is it really just a question of like having the ability to just have equal ports on it? I don't know, how do you feel?
I agree with your last sentence. I think the whole issue of power is less to do with, oh God, my console's less powerful, therefore I'm not going to have as good of an experience. I think the big issue is, oh, I'm a third-party developer and I just want to put my game on all the systems. Oh, I'm only going to do it on these systems and not the Nintendo one because it's too much effort to try and make a different version that works on a lower-powered system. I think that's right. Just the concern, isn't it? The concern is that the NX is just going to fall behind because it's not going to get the third-party support, and as a result, might suffer when the big AAA games that come out on all the consoles come out. And it's really hard to say at this stage whether that will happen or not. I mean, like at the start of Wii U, it had some third-party support, and that's the same with like GameCube and Wii, is that there's more third-party support at the start when, you know, companies are just dipping their toe in to see how it's going to do. But I worry about power for that simple reason, that it's going to fall behind in terms of third-party support, and I completely accept I'm in a massive minority of people who is Nintendo solely, and I quite like playing, you know, the big third-party games when they come out every now and then and hope that they would come to NX. So it would concern me, but power has never hindered Nintendo necessarily in the past. And like you said, PS4 selling so well is a unique position where the most powerful system is selling in the way it has.
Yeah, I do think it's not power, but parity is what the problem is. And Nintendo often in the recent generations have chosen to make some strange, unique twist on their console. And I think that's something else that scares third parties away is, okay, I'd like to develop for the system, but I have to do something with the gamepad, and that means dedicating people to develop stuff specifically for that, and to make sure that is integrated well. It's not like the simple process of just copy-pasting. It never is, honestly, copy, you know. That's not, it's a very huge misconception that, like, porting from one platform to the other is that easy. But, like, having Nintendo's whatever the hell their new thing is, that's probably a bigger concern, actually, is like, yeah, they could be power parity like the Wii U was, but like, what happens when you have to accommodate for these extra elements that Nintendo are putting in there And then you're like, oh, okay, well, I don't really have enough manpower to put behind this version, which probably won't sell that well because it's a Nintendo version. It's a conundrum. It's something that I feel it's going to be hard for them to reconcile unless they have something that's bog standard. And then the question is, like, why would anyone care? Because then you have three competitors in the marketplace who are exactly the same. And what's the differentiating factor? Of course, first-party games. But, like, has that worked for Sony? No. Like, they have nothing third-party or first-party-wise. And they've still shot ahead. So, yeah.
I mean, this is me talking from a very non-technology kind of base. But the gap doesn't feel as big anymore. Like, when you compared the Wii to the PS3 and stuff, like, the gap felt quite big, and you could really,
I mean, you
see,
had the HD barrier to overcome.
Precisely.
There.
Like, I feel like, obviously, frame rate and processing is incredibly important, but games on the Wii U just look fantastic. And, like, if you just ask someone, like an alien from another planet, to come and play, you know, a PS4 game versus a Wii U game, they might think that the Wii U is more powered just because of how slick the experience is. Like, for me as a gamer, a very shallow, like, level, they don't look that much different to me.
I think it also has to do with Nintendo's own characters and their stable of franchises being the sort of more cartoony, more kind of
and they can really
colorful.
Optimize it. Exactly.
Yeah, they can leverage their artwork over the power of their resolution, you know? If you put Splatoon alongside, say, The Witcher on PS4, I would say that Splatoon probably looks better, mainly because it runs at 60 frames per second. And, like, there's a smoothness and an ability to, you know, overlook a lot of maybe kind of low-resolution textures by leveraging lighting effects and leveraging, yeah, like, different aspects. And so certainly, I don't think Nintendo even needs a more powerful console to make their games look better, because they already look fantastic on Wii U. I think the big gap this generation is really between the PC and the console platforms. Like, that's where you're seeing the major difference. And so, Nintendo, I don't know. Like, I think the problem is, as Nintendo fans, we know that none of this matters to us, but I don't know when you get out into the wider marketplace and you know, target the people who are just buying FIFA every year. They probably care more about the buzzwords of power and everything over anything else. So
yeah,
there is a worry there.
It's a weird one that's going to keep coming up as we get closer to the NX launch.
Which seems to be slipping further and further away.
Which we'll be covering in 2019. So
yes.
Look forward.
Yep. We'll be on episode 200. So it'll be fun.
And with that, another question, the final question about the NX. Well, final question for this week, but it's also about the NX. Kevin from St. Louis, Missouri. Do you guys think, with the way rewards are set up in the My Nintendo account system, that the NX platform will be digital only? I really like having physical copies of games, but I think I could make the switch if I were forced to. I've noticed that most software companies now only publish digitally, and newer PCs and Macs don't even have optical drives. Thanks, Kevin in St. Louis, Missouri.
So, I don't think it's going to be digital. I think we probably talked before that we don't think it's going to be digital only. That would be suicide at this point in time, mainly because internet infrastructures and everything still, I don't think, are up to snuff. The US is getting there. I think a lot of parts of Europe, mainly like Eastern Europe and places, have like surprisingly amazing internet, so that's fine there. But like, there are lots of parts of the world which still are not set up well enough for this to be viable. But I do think that the main thrust behind My Nintendo is to push people towards digital. Like, this is a real effort to say, we're going to really reward you if you choose digital. And if you choose physical, that's fine. But you're not going to get these benefits of the gold coins, which you can then feed back into
it's percentages
of.
It's already happening to me, NBC.
Yeah, Bally, how about you tell people? Because we kind of... Sure. Did a bit of research to try and find out how the My Nintendo stuff worked.
Yeah, so we both go through this rigmarole every time a new game comes out. We compare digital price to buying the game from Amazon or an online site. So in this case, I wanted to pick up Star Fox Zero. Checked Amazon. I think it was 32 to 36 quid. But once you started, me being in Brussels, I get it delivered from like the UK because there's no Brussels. There's no Belgium Amazon. It's complicated. But anyway, it costs like an extra 5 quid or so to get it delivered. So by the time I get it delivered, it might come to maybe £38. And ultimately online, it just costs £40. So I can digitally just download it there and then for an extra 2 quid, which kind of feels decent. And then when you now add on top of that the new My Nintendo account system, I'm getting 60 star coins. So for 60 star coins, there's like a whole bunch of stuff I can do. Like, for example, I think I'm for about 20 star coins, I can get 10% off Fire Emblem Fates, which is coming out like in a couple of weeks, less than a couple of weeks. So like, it's put me in this spiral where I'm buying a game, I'm getting star coins, and then using those star coins, I'm buying another game.
And then I'm getting more star coins.
Exactly. And I'm already on that spiral. And I'm not saying it's a healthy or an unhealthy spiral. I'm effectively more or less spending the same amount of money as I would be ordering games from Amazon. Just about. It's just about the same.
But with the added benefit that you don't have to wait for it to be delivered.
Precisely. The added benefit is I don't have to wait for it to be delivered. Obviously, the downside is I can't lend you my game when I'm done with it, for example.
Right, absolutely. Like,
it might be quite nice that I could have had Star Fox Zero said, here, you try it out, MBZ. I can't do that. But it's pretty cool. I quite like digital. It's grown on me more and more the longer I've owned a Wii U. We both have now hard drives for our Wii Us, and we do.
Like,
massive SD cards for our 3DSs. And mm-hmm. It's just so nice just to download a game and start playing it. And like, I might even like do, you know, the stereotypical thing. I hope it's a Friday night and I could like stay up late, wait for Fire Emblem Fates to come out, download it, and then play a couple of hours and go to bed. And like, you know, that's quite a nice little, you know, childish feeling to just like get something like day one,
having the midnight and waiting until the last second. It's cool.
Is it a path that you might choose at some point, MBZ?
It is. Again, we talk about the huge difference in pricing in the UK specifically. Like, the fact that eShop games are usually 50 quid, whereas on Amazon I can get them from, like, a Wii U retail game sometimes for 30, you know? Like, that is huge. That's an enormous gap in price. And it's just not worth it. I think the difference being, like, if we lived in America, then they have generally the $60 kind of across the board pricing for when it kind of comes out straight away. And that is the same across both. And because of that, it would make way more sense to go digital, because then you're paying the same price anyway, but you're just getting more benefits. As it stands right now, like, it just doesn't make any sense. Like, for you, totally, because you have that extra cost associated with the, you know, the import or whatever from the UK to Brussels. But it's all about retail needing to die. As soon as retail dies, then I think we can get to this point where digital versions of games become cheaper and it's just much more palatable to say day one, I'm going to download it and just have it.
And might help Nintendo financially. Like, all your money is just going to them.
So. Yeah, they don't have to pay anything to someone else. Like, it is one-to-one. So they definitely reap the reward in that sense.
But like we said, NX most likely still has an optical drive.
Yeah.
Or a cart. But anyway, that's another conversation.
Oh, God, who knows?
But that is all we have time for with emails this time. Time for this time? Time for this? Can I start?
You're a time lord.
But that's all we have time for today. I just about to say that's all we have time for this time.
I know.
All right, here we go. And that's all we've got time for this episode of This Nintendo Life. Like I said at the top of the segment, please send in more emails. The email address is thisnintendolife@gmail.com. That is thisnintendolife@gmail.com. Join us in a few seconds after a nice musical interlude for the third segment.
Welcome back, everyone, to the third and final segment of this here podcast show. We have a few things to talk about, Bally, for our kind of sort of news roundup, a little bit here, a little bit there.
Mixed news.
Yeah, mixed news, I'll say, for sure. We've got three things, Bally. Which one do you want to tackle first? I'll give you the choice.
Let's go with the worst news, which is probably the digital event.
Sure. Well, so here's the interesting thing about this is I don't think Nintendo explicitly stated that they were not having a Nintendo Digital event. They stated by omission, I guess, which is to say that we know from history that traditionally the Nintendo press conference, or in recent years the Nintendo Digital event, has taken place at 9 a.m. Pacific time on the Tuesday of E3, right? That's mm-hmm. when they usually do their presentation of whatever form it takes.
For the last, like, however many years
since E3's been a thing, basically, yeah. So what they announced was instead, at 9 a.m, they would kick off a live stream of The Legend of Zelda on Wii U, which would then go for however many hours for the rest of the day. And then nothing else. So they didn't talk about live stream for the days after, which we have had in the past for Treehouse, where they've showed other games off. They said nothing about a digital event. Basically, they said they weren't having one, and so because they're saying they're not, of course everyone's like, well, by omission, they must not be having one. I'm sure there are people holding on to hope, but that seems stupid. Like, why would they not announce it as part of their plans? We can assume that there's not going to be anything. So, Bally, how badly does this affect E3 and Nintendo's presence? Let me hear your take.
Just very quickly, the last couple of years we've had this sort of teaser video, remember?
Yes, yeah, right, with Reggie doing a punch-out training montage and stuff like
that. Does that normally come out in May?
It usually comes out... Oh, God, I don't know. It must do, because, like, it's right before E3. It's a month before. I'm pretty sure it has in the past. Yeah, and those were great videos, and they really set up, like, okay, we're doing this thing on the Sunday with the championship and before with the Smash tournament. Like, all that big blowout stuff seems like there's nothing. Like, it feels very un-Nintendo in the way they announced it, in the way that, like, it's all been set up. There's a remove to it that there hasn't been in the past. There's less whimsy and fun with the announcement. I guess because there's not much fun to announce, but, you know.
If they were going to do something like that, that sort of preamble video would probably come like in this next week or so, wouldn't it?
Probably, yeah. I'm not going to hold out any hope.
Back to your first question, is this bad? It's pretty bad, but it's not infinitely worse than the news we've already had, if that makes sense. It kind of ties in with it.
I mean, it's just
suitably.
Really rubbing salt in the wound, if nothing else, you know?
It's, yeah, and... The biggest part of it for me, really, is that I don't want to see too much of Zelda on Wii U.
Right.
I want a nice short trailer that gets me excited, and maybe 5-10 minutes of gameplay just to see it in action. I don't need an hour or two of streaming. I just want a little bit.
And it's more. It's like 6 hours. Like, it's absurd. That's the thing, like, I'm not sure if that's going to be wholly original new stuff for the 6 hours. Like, you can imagine a situation where it's like, okay, we've got a 30-minute segment of this outside exploring, and then they're like, cut to, let's talk to Anuma for an hour. Then it's like, oh, let's go back, let's do, like, a dungeon kind of mini-segment. And then it's like, oh, let's cut to another interview for however long. And then it's like, oh, let's go back to that open segment and see if we can find something else in this kind of same area, you know? Like, there's a way that they can repurpose the similar sort of demo or footage or whatever to make it so that they're not showing too much but continuing to have a presence on a live stream, you know?
Yeah, it's going to be a tough balance, and I hope they don't muck it up.
Well, it's all to do with you, though, isn't it? It's like, you're the person in control of how much you watch,
yeah,
ultimately.
You've just got to resist that glorious new Zelda, which
yeah.
I think in the long run it's worth trying to avoid, but...
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if this game is as big as we think it's going to be, maybe showing that much isn't actually that damaging to the experience. Like, you think about other open world games and, like, the hundreds of hours people invest, and then 6 hours seems like really a drop in the puddle when that's kind of taken into consideration. But, yeah, I don't know. It's weird. Like, I was tweeting and talking about this, and I was saying, like, really, Nintendo going to E3 makes no fucking sense at all. Like, I think they would have looked... infinitely stronger if they had said, no, we're not going to E3. We don't need E3. We can do our own thing. Fuck you. And we will see you whenever for the NX event and everything like that. And it just seems like, I imagine the reason for this, and this has been brought up by someone to me, I can't remember where, probably Twitter or something, but the reason why they are back here at E3 doing stuff, having a booth space is... they probably paid for that booth space already, and in order to keep their spot for next year, they need to have booth space this year. Because of the nature of pushing to the back of the queue, if you give up your space, Nintendo doing that would mean that, yes, they have nothing to show this year, but they'll want to be at E3 next year, most likely, and have a big booth to show a bunch of shit. And that means not losing their prime location. So
yeah,
it
that
sucks,
makes sense.
But they kind of have to do it for future, you know, for insurance, basically.
Yeah, no, you're right, and I agree. And it would have been quite a cool principled stance of, we don't have to be at E3, we're not here at all, we're launching our the NX later. What's the need for us to be here? That would have been quite cool. Would have been quite interesting. Would have fitted into the narrative that E3 is very different to what it was before, and perhaps isn't as big of a hype train as it once was.
Yeah.
But that's the way it is. So I guess we'll see. It's not great.
I don't want to talk too much more about it. It's just kind of depressing, really. It's not a fun subject.
Shall we go for some more bad news or a bit of good news?
You know, let's kick all the bad stuff out early. Let's finish strong.
Let's go
with the other bad news, which is that Disney have decided to basically cease being a video game publisher. They have closed Avalanche, the studio that made Disney Infinity. They have cut their Toys to Life line. They have basically said, we're moving into licensing, and all of it is done. And I will read a statement here that they put out regarding all of this. They say, after a thorough evaluation, we have modified our approach to console gaming and will transition exclusively to a licensing model. This shift in strategy means we will cease production of Disney Infinity, where the lack of growth in the Toys to Life market, coupled with high development costs, has created a challenging business model. This means that we will be shutting down Avalanche, our internal studio that developed the game. This was a difficult decision that we did not take lightly, given the quality of Disney Infinity and its many passionate fans. So it's very, very interesting. This is a big story because I think it is applicable to Nintendo in the sense that they are very much a big player in this so-called Toys to Life market that Disney are seeming to feel is having lack of growth and kind of waning somewhat. How do you feel that this potentially affects Nintendo as a player in the space and maybe affects the whole genre of the Toys to Life thing, Bally?
I see this sort of very widely as Disney are the family-friendly organization of entertainment, but they can't get into the video game space because Nintendo are the family-friendly video game sort of masters of that realm. And in the same way that I think Nintendo might struggle to get into the film industry, I think Disney have struggled to get into the video games industry. Like, of course, Disney is this unbelievably big corporation. I think it's one of the biggest six companies in the United States. And it's crazy that they've not just pushed harder and harder and spent more and more to try and shove their way into this market. But it just seems like they think that they're up against too much. And whether that up against too much is Nintendo specifically and Amiibos, or whether it's just the wider general trends in gaming, is maybe hard to say. But I think it's, you know, they've stepped into some territory that they're not comfortable with, and they've decided, you know what, rather than getting our leg bitten off, let's pull it out.
I think the thing that you can say that is a similarity between Disney and Nintendo is that they both have a very high bar of quality, right?
Definitely.
And I think when you look at the Disney Infinity figures, they're some of the best out there. They really are well made. They look amazing.
They have lightsabers that light up.
Exactly. Like, there is a level of detail and a overall aesthetic that is fitting between all their franchises that kind of melds, and like from Star Wars to, you know, The Little Mermaid to whatever, like to Pixar, they all those characters have the same kind of feel and design to them, which is a tough thing to do when you're bringing together all these different things. And I do think that, like, maybe it just wasn't worth it. Like, despite the fact they were probably selling well, the upfront cost of production of those things probably didn't justify how much money they were bringing in on the other end. I think Disney are the kind of company where they can make so much more money by just licensing out their franchises and their products to other people.
Definitely.
And just reaping the reward and not having to put up that, you know, capital up front and make that money.
They've got the characters. They've got Star Wars. They've got Marvel. I mean, the second they start giving those licenses out to some big heavyweight players, maybe even Nintendo, although that seems unlikely, who knows what could happen? I think you could get a really nice string of strong games, and hopefully, who knows, some Star Wars games.
Do you think that this is maybe the bubble beginning to burst? The fact that Disney are, like, moving away from the Toys to Life market? Like, I heard someone compare it to the idea that, you know, a music game from last generation had this kind of very brief period of time where they were this raging craze and then just poof, like, out of the blue disappeared. Will that happen with these Toys to Life games?
It's hard to say.
Will Nintendo be affected by it? That's interesting.
I mean, it's interesting that Disney are so affected by it, and it doesn't seem like Nintendo are necessarily affected in the same way. Or maybe they are behind the scenes and we just don't know about that. And actually, in fact, Amiibo is incredibly expensive and everything they're producing is maybe not worth it in the long run. So it'll be interesting to see if Nintendo keep going as whole hog as they are, but I can't see them slowing down anytime soon, I guess. And I don't really know the sales figures of Disney Infinity characters versus Amiibos, but I'm going to gamble that Amiibo are probably doing a bit stronger. So maybe it's just a case of there's just too many Disney characters, and ultimately in a video game space, people want to buy video game characters, not necessarily Disney characters.
Yeah, I think that Nintendo is slightly different because the way that Amiibo function, most people don't buy them for the game, right? Like, when you have Skylanders, Lego Dimension, Disney Infinity, they're all intrinsically tied into a piece of software that this figure will 100% work in, and that's what you use it for. Whereas Amiibo, I think this may be to do with just a wider question of Nintendo's own merchandise and that kind of thing. It's like, they are a decent quality for a good price official Nintendo merchandise, and I think people like Disney have other avenues to do that kind of stuff at higher quality for their fans, as opposed to just these figures that work in this one game. Whereas, like, Nintendo is like, this works in all our software, but also these are kind of more collectible things, you know? It feels like that's the kind of market that's happening, as opposed to it being, you know, slavishly kind of tied to one piece of, you know, entertainment or whatever.
But it's interesting news altogether, and it's a shame because Disney's a cool company. They do a lot of great stuff,
and you know, Disney Infinity all
around is pretty cool.
We were thinking at one point, like, oh man, those Star Wars figures look cool. Maybe we should play some Disney Infinity.
We were both prepared to dip our toe in, and I think I might still be keen to at least try it out just to see.
I mean, prices may go down on this stuff, who knows?
Yeah.
Might be easier to get stuff for cheap, so we may dip our toe into the realm at some point. But enough of the sadness, Bal. Let's talk about happy fucking owls. It's Pokemon time. They announced the starters for Pokemon Sun and Moon, as well as the two new legendaries. And the internet went fucking wild. You know what astounds me is every time they announce new Pokemon starters, all of a sudden, within like 5 minutes, there are like incredible pieces of fan art. And like, I think it wasn't even 24 hours before someone would post it online, like a really well-made, handcrafted like plush of Rowlet. I was like, Jesus, the internet works fast when they're dedicated to some kind of fandom like Pokemon. It's kind of absurd.
Before this trailer, did we know that this game was going to be a seventh generation?
I think we had assumptions that it was going to be. Okay. I don't know that it was, like, concretely announced, but, like, I think everyone, like, implicitly knew that it was going to be. I think there was maybe some doubters, but I think, yeah, generally across the board, we're like, yeah, it's going to be the new generation, so.
Okay, good. I mean, I think the trailer looked great. It looked like a complete... not a complete change, but it looked like a decent change from X and Y. And like you said, those starters look cool. I think it just looked like a slicker game than X and Y, which, like you said earlier in the show, is just kind of, you can't implement 3D. It looks very chibi. It looks a bit strange. I don't know. This just looked more vibrant and smoother.
It definitely feels a little more mature, I guess. I don't know, like the protagonists being like human sized and everything, and well proportioned, and just for me, being removed from Pokemon, the competitive stuff and everything for like 2 years maybe now, I guess, maybe a year and a half, or I mean, it actually probably is like over
it's been
a year,
while.
Year and a half. It's been some time since I did play the Pokemon frequently. Watching this trailer, like, and not keeping up with the news and not really knowing what it was going in, just gave me this kind of almost childlike joy again. I don't know. It's something I've been missing from Pokemon for a while. It's like it kind of got this spark.
You got a bit excited.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. Like it almost had me by the balls again. Pokemon has that unique way of doing that. But I see these new starters. I'm like, oh, it looks so cool. There's like it
so
hit me in a way
it
that it hasn't. I don't know. There needs to be more there. I think as a guttural reaction, it was like, oh god, this is cool. But like, I look at the location they've chosen. I see it's kind of based on Hawaii and islands. And I look and there's a lot of fucking water. And that reminds me of Omega Ruby Alpha Sapphire, which was so fucking horrible. It made me quit the franchise. And, you know, there are ways that this game could end up not being great.
Mm-hmm.
But at the moment, I just think it's looking real good. The new Pokemon look great. I think it's the best set of starters we've had in a while. Rowlet is the cutest fucking thing in the world. And if anything is going to break me out of my time-honored tradition of picking the water starter, is that little goddamn owl, I'll tell you.
It all depends what the first and second evolutions look like.
That's true. That's very true. But as a big Noctowl fan, as someone who has used that Pokemon as my avatar, it's currently my avatar on NeoGAF, owls in Pokemon, I don't know, it's something about it that I'm a fan of. So, what do you think of the other starters and Rowlet itself, Bally? Which one would you choose? Are you not willing to reveal that at this point?
Oh, jeez. I don't know. I don't really buy Pokemon games yes or no based on what the starters look like.
No, I know, but like, just what do you like them or not? I don't know.
Yeah, I like them. I think the little grass owl, he's great. There's like a water seal dog thing.
Yep,
it looks all right. And then there's Poplia, the boring fire cat.
Which, yeah, as I said in our poll, generic fire cat.
Litten
is a good name, though, I have to say. That's pretty legit.
I think it looks cool. I having played Red at the start, just like that last month, and then hopefully playing this in come November, I think it'd be nice. It'd be a nice Christmas game to play, especially seeing as there might not be too much else.
Do you have a preference on either Sun or Moon based on those two legendaries as well? because I think that's something that kind of ticks the needle for me. It's not a big deal, right. But like I always choose based on those.
Remind me which was which. One was a big fire lion, is that?
Yeah, so sun is a massive fire lion, and then moon is this kind of night bat, big bat thing.
Yeah, I'm much like the starters. I'm pretty easy. I'll pick up whichever one you want me to, MP said, so you can get the other one.
Yeah, if I end up playing the game, which we'll see, I would 100% go for Sun, because that fucking, like, that looks like Entei's long-lost father, and he seems legit as hell. Like, crazy fucking main, white hot. It's, yeah, that's a great legend design, I think. They have done a good job of making Pokemon look very good. I don't know. Like contrasting to our Yo-Kai Watch conversation, these are very visually pleasing and aesthetically pleasing designs.
Yeah. And like, it's great that people are still excited by Pokemon. Like, it's incredible. It's such a cool franchise, and long may it continue.
I'm sure it will. I don't see it stopping anytime soon. I guess there's not much else going after that news. There wasn't anything like, I don't know, I haven't really been keeping up because I don't care anymore. But, you know, I'm sure other people have dug and found different details. That's pretty much it for those three little bits of roundup. We're going to have to find some other things to talk about, Bally, because leading up to E3 and the next few months, it's hard to put things together.
We can do a bit more jukebox, perhaps.
We could do, and there's a few we'll other have ideas. Some backlog club maybe later in the summer.
That'd be good.
So things coming up, things on the horizon. But that's going to end this segment, and that will also coincidentally end the show. So Bally, before we go, let's plug ourselves. Let's talk things. Let's say stuff.
Have all the Jedi been executed yet?
Anakin just walked into the youngling room.
Oh, God.
And the kid said, "Master Anakin, we're surrounded. What do we do?" And then cut to black.
That is dark, isn't
it's
it?
Fucking
can you
so
believe-
dark.
That movie
that is the, that's
be
the
an
moment.
18.
So that is the moment where my sister was like, "Fuck this movie, I don't want to watch this anymore."
That was the moment where I was like, "I cannot stop watching this film, it is great."
Oh, yeah. Yeah, love it.
Oh, man.
Love it.
Brutal.
So, Bally, execute order 66. What's your Twitter handle? Where can we find
my
you?
My Twitter handle is @Ballyman91. That's BallyMan91. I am so close to 300 followers. I'm on 291, so do please give me a follow.
Only nine.
There.
We need nine people to follow back. That's nothing.
It's just nine of you out there. Just go on. And I'm also on the Miiverse at Ballyman91 as well. And I'm going to be playing some Star Fox and posting lots of glorious Miiverse posts.
Excellent.
I have been playing Prime 2, and obviously I cannot post on the Miiverse with the Wii Virtual Console. So go follow me on there too.
So, you know something about Miiverse that's also been irking me is I couldn't post any screenshots from Yo-Kai Watch. And I was like, why can't I do this? And someone was like, so because Yo-Kai Watch came out in Japan in 2013 before the 3DS Miiverse was implemented, there's no screenshot functionality. And I'm like, well, that makes no fucking sense. It came out 2016 in my country. Like, it should... Oh, my God. It really pissed me off. Because that game looks so, so good. I really wanted to, like, post some screenshots, and it wouldn't let me. So fuck you, Miiverse, basically. And that's stupid. Also, Nano Assault EX, which was also part of the Humble Bundle, I started playing some of that and tried to post a screenshot. There's not even a community for Nano Assault EX. So, Miiverse, fucking pick your shit up, man. Dude, get it sorted. This is not acceptable. Not acceptable at all. In any case, you can still follow me on Miiverse. I'm LordNBZ. Also on Twitter, @LordNBZ. You can find the show in various places. We're on iTunes. We are on Stitcher. I looked into the Google podcast thing. Apparently, it's not available in our country yet. So I'm sorry, everyone who wants the Google stuff, but my country doesn't support your fucking stupid thing yet. So tell Google to hurry their shit up and get it sorted, and then I'll try and get it on their service. But until then, you know, with everything, we just have to fucking wait 7 months. Fire Emblem. So, yes, you can also find us on YouTube, usually on Wednesdays, the audio version of the podcast on Mondays, ordinarily. So there's the schedule that we keep. And you can also review us on iTunes. Reviews are really helpful. They help push the show out to more people, get it into other earbuds, and, you know, increase all the interaction, all that stuff. We also have an email address and a podcast Twitter that you can follow. Podcast Twitter is at TNL Podcast. Bally, what's the email address?
The email address is thisnintendolife@gmail.com. That is thisnintendolife@gmail.com. And we always need more emails, so do send those in.
Yes, as we said before, we don't have much to talk about, so give us shit to talk about. yes, we will be back in your ear holes in another couple of weeks' time. But until then, thank you for listening, and we'll see you in a little while. Goodbye. The musical interludes used in today's episode were Trip Through Sequin Land from Shantae and the Pirate's Curse, copyright Way Forward 2014, and Uptown Springdale from Yo-Kai Watch, copyright Level 5 2013.
For me personally, there are plenty of examples I could bring up, but I think the most egregious one is that my Twitter handle is at Atari Alex, but I have never played an Atari. I only picked the name because of its alliterative.
I thought you were going to say because of its alliteration.
I just added a stupid off. I'm going to read the last sentence again.
The big gap. God damn it. Fucking god damn it. I can cut in. Fucking piece of shit.
Execute Order 66.